Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Professor of International Affairs at Harvard University, the John F. Kennedy School of Government. Mike's criticized me for my short introductions of people.
Incomplete, not short. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Mike Cosentino here. Not your short introductions, your incomplete introductions. And we got a guy today that has a pedigree here that we want to be proud of.
But it would be 10 pages long if we talked about all his books.
Well, you better get started then.
All right. All right. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am.
Stephen Walt is professor of international affairs at Harvard University's John F. Kennedy School of Government. He received his PhD from Cal Berkeley. He achieved notice in the field of political science early in his career with a paper called Alliance Formation and the Balance of World Power. The theory called the balance of threat theory. It's a widely recognized innovation in political science theory. He's a leading proponent of what's called the realist school of international affairs. And he's written a number of extraordinarily well-received books on the balance of power, nature of alliances, connection between war and revolution, how revolution can start wars with nearby countries. Most people, no matter how closely they follow international affairs, don't think themselves consciously belonging to any school of political thought. Most of you folks out there don't even know these schools exist, these approaches. Most people view international affairs through sort of their domestic politics of being liberals or conservatives or moderate. Maybe we can talk about the realist school later. From the outside, it looks like Stephen Walt is leading a very distinguished, astonishingly successful, quiet academic career. And then in March 2006, he and John Mersheimer published a working paper entitled The Israeli Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy on the Negative Effects of Unmatched Power of the Israeli Lobby. Wikipedia says very mildly, the articles generated considerable media coverage throughout the world. The book that follows becomes a bestseller. It's a word we can't use on the radio, but it caused, we can use the word crap, right? It caused a crap storm of considerable proportions. And it must have been for a really abrupt and shocking interest from going to entrance from being a respected academic to being a public intellectual. I'll give you a tenor of some of the stuff out there. There's a fairly recent article entitled, Is Stephen Walt Blind, a Complete Fool, or a Big Liar? By Martin Perez. That gets you some tenor of the controversy. People around the world square off on one side or the other of the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. But I think what we'd like to talk about today is suppose we want, and put it very idealistically, a just, peaceful, stable, prosperous civil societies and governments for both people. We can talk about the Israeli lobby, but my first question is, as peace talks are now starting, is what is a reasonable way, how can we move peace forward, I guess, is to put simply, are there mechanisms, is there somebody who can bring peace finally to the Middle East? Because it seems like a pivot where if you could get peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, it would have this crescendo, ice-breaking effect.
I think that, in fact, as valuable as it would be to have peace arrangements between the Israelis and the Palestinians after, you know, many decades and suffering on both sides, it's a mistake to think that that's like the master key that unlocks everything else. If we magically got a peace deal tomorrow between Israelis and Palestinians that satisfied both sides reasonably well, not everything they wanted, but reasonably well, it would have virtually no impact on what's going going on in Syria. It would have relatively little impact on the struggle for power occurring in Egypt. It would not, in the short term, it seems to me, affect the conflicts between Sunnis and Shia in Iraq or between Arabs in the Gulf and their concerns about Iran. It would have some very positive effects for Israel, some very positive effects for the Palestinians, and it would certainly go a long way to removing one of the sources of anti-Americanism in that region. But there are lots of other problems in that part of the world that would not be directly affected by even something as wonderful as an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal.
Professor Wall, let's talk about America's role in all of this. First of all, in your writing, you talked about John Kerry saying right things right now. What's he saying right, and what would be doing something right as far as the quote-unquote peace process is concerned?
Well, I think the most important thing Kerry has said, and he's said this a number of times now, is that the window for some kind of two-state solution is closing. Some people actually believe it is already closed,
right.
But he's basically saying we have, you know, a year or two, we might be able to do something. And for many years, that's been seen as the sort of least bad alternative to finally resolve this very lengthy conflict. Basically, the creation of a Palestinian state, a viable state on virtually all of the West Bank and Gaza, and then the establishment of secure borders for these two countries, Israel and the new Palestinian state. And he's basically saying that given all the other trends that are taking place there, if this doesn't happen soon, it's not going to happen ever, and we'll have to start thinking about alternatives, and most of those alternatives look much worse. So I think there he's right. What's missing, as near as we can tell from the outside, is anything that looks like a significantly different American approach to the problem. So Kerry has been there now five or six times talking with people on both sides, and he's persuaded them to send representatives to have talks about how the talks are going to be conducted. They're not really even talking about substance yet. They're really just talking about procedures. And there's no sign yet that the United States is either going to propose a plan of its own or use its leverage with both sides, not just one, to try and force a deal. That's why I'm not particularly optimistic that this is going to ultimately lead to a genuine solution. I think it will ultimately kick the can down the road for a while, and then the talks will break down and we'll be back where we started, only a little worse off.
One of the really interesting ironies that in your writing also is how, and I want to, and I'm going to frame it in the question, how is the U.S. support for Israel, which has been criticized worldwide, but it was almost a knee-jerk support for Israel. How is it bad for Israel? You say that the U.S. support for Israel is bad for Israel. How so?
I think the most obvious example of this is that the United States has basically turned a blind eye to Israel's settlement policy ever since 1967. It has been the official policy of the U.S. government, going all the way back to Lyndon Johnson, to oppose the construction of Israeli settlements on the territories that were conquered in the Six-Day War. We have said repeatedly that we thought these were a hindrance to peace. Some American presidents have said that they were illegal, but the United States has never done anything concrete to actually stop them. In fact, given that we give Israel between $3 and $4 billion a year, we are in effect indirectly subsidizing them, and we're also providing some diplomatic protection by vetoing UN Security Council resolutions, etc., that are critical of this policy. Now, the danger here, of course, is it's allowed Israel to continue to establish these settlements. There are now over 500,000 people living outside the original 1967 border. And this has created a situation where a two-state solution may be essentially impossible. And that, in turn, creates a situation where Israel can't be simultaneously democratic and also a Jewish state, because if you look down the road, eventually there may be more Arabs than Jews living there. This is something that is not good for Israel's future. In fact, it's probably the single most serious threat to Israel's long-term future. And the United States has essentially been the enabler of this policy, even though we opposed it and even though we knew it was probably not in Israel's long-term interest.
Let me indulge in my own realist school of foreign policy for a minute and say, well, given the situation of all these Israelis, all these living in the occupied territories, The next step would be a Palestinian state that encompassed all or part of the occupied territories with Israelis living there. How possible is that?
I think it's not obviously an ideal outcome, although one could imagine that situation emerging. Again, imagine hypothetically that there's an agreement and a new Palestinian state is created. The Israeli Jews who are now living there could be allowed to stay if they wished, or they could move back to Israel with some form of compensation. But the far more likely outcome, it seems to me, at this point, is that you will get essentially a single state on what was originally Israel plus the West Bank. It will contain a population that's 40 to 50 or so percent Palestinians, and there'll be tremendous pressure over time for those citizens or those inhabitants to be given political rights. And you can imagine a one-state democracy emerging there, and a few people have proposed that. The problem there is binational states of that sort do not always work particularly well, particularly when there is a long history of conflict between the two groups. And it also means the end of the Zionist dream, which is something that most Israeli Jews would, of course, oppose vehemently. But that's where we're headed if we don't get a two-state solution. And as Secretary Kerry has said, the window for achieving that is very, very short indeed.
Is there a single major obstacle to peace between the Palestinians and the Israeli? Is there a single or several major obstacles to peace that we can identify and try to figure out how to overcome?
The bad news here is it's not just one. It would be much simpler if there was simply one, you know, lever one could twist and that would cause it. No, it seems to me the problems are severalfold. One, the Israeli body politic has been drifting steadily to the right, and the current government coalition led by Prime Minister Netanyahu is probably the most right-wing pro-settlement government in Israel's history. So there's no political pressure on him from his own people to cut a deal. Second, the Palestinians are deeply divided. The Palestinian Authority doesn't have enormous popularity. Hamas is not even part of the negotiation, so you don't have a unified group to talk to on the Palestinian side. Third, the United States is not exactly even-handed here. We're completely supportive of one side and not particularly supportive of the other, so we don't have a lot of credibility. And last but not least, if you just stepped back for a moment and looked at everything else that's happening in the region, this is not a moment where you would expect many leaders to be willing to take risks, even with the prospect of peace ahead of them. You have a civil war in Syria, uncertainty in Egypt, lots of other trouble, potential trouble in places like Jordan and Lebanon. That's sort of the last moment where you would expect anyone to take a bold step that might involve some risks.
Let's take up one or two of those.
Put all those together, and it's not a moment to be particularly optimistic.
Right.
Let's take Syria or Egypt, whatever you'd like to address, and talk about what's going on there. You've been skeptical about too much U.S. involvement in Syria. I thought a really interesting article, which was in some ways very simple. And you said nobody knows what's going to happen in Egypt, and the Egyptians don't know what's going to happen in Egypt.
That's correct. Let me take Egypt first and then Syria. One thing we know by just studying the history of other revolutions is that they take a long time to work themselves out. Once an existing political order has in effect collapsed or been discredited and there are no set rules or new constitutions have to be written, it doesn't get solved in a month or 6 months or even a year. And the people who lose out in the first round, often trying to find ways to pull a reset, as we've just seen in Egypt, where the military government was not happy with what the Muslim Brotherhood government was doing and essentially staged a coup to start all over. This process could continue for years. The French Revolution, begins in 1789, and Napoleon takes power 10 years later. the American Revolution. It begins with the Articles of Confederation, and we don't really get our final constitution until 10 years or so later as well. So I think Egypt is a completely uncertain circumstance right now, where no one, not us, not the Egyptians, and no one in the region really knows what condition Egypt is going to be in 2 or 3 or 4 years from now. And just to make that even worse, whoever ends up governing Egypt is going to face an enormous set of economic and social problems, and the question will be is which one of these various contenders for power will find a way to get the Egyptian economy growing again, which is ultimately essential.
You suggested, didn't you, that we cut our economic aid to the Egyptian military and take half of it or another and put it into civilian aid to Egypt that's going to very badly need it?
Right. We give Egypt between $1 and $2 billion a year, primarily in military aid and various types of weaponry. And if you look at Egypt's security situation, they really don't need any more high-tech weapons. They're not about to be attacked or invaded by anyone. Those aren't an effective defense. What Egypt needs is food and jobs and education and economic growth.
And stability for tourism.
Yes, I mean, domestic security, definitely, so you can get people to go there as tourists again and feel like they're going to be safe. But you don't need F-16 aircraft and, advanced tanks in order to have domestic security. You need government institutions that are working more effectively, a government with genuine legitimacy, et cetera. You need a non-corrupt and reasonably effective police force, and American military aid isn't doing anything to provide those things. So I did write a piece saying that, if we really wanted to help Egypt, we wouldn't send them weapons. We'd be sending them food aid and educational assistance and things like that. And that would be a better return on the $1 to $2 billion of U.S. aid that we provide.
It's such a simple idea. What are the chances of getting the U.S. to do that? I mean, it's so obviously true.
Because right now the American government, I mean, there are people in Congress who have called for cutting the aid package, but I'd rather not cut it. I'd just rather redirect it. But I think we see this, or the U.S. government sees this, as the best way to retain some leverage or some influence with the Egyptian military, and given that they are the ones running the country right now, I think that's what they're seeing as the payoff for us. I think even there, the amount of real influence we get is quite limited.
But when we talked to Noam Chomsky, he said it doesn't matter whether it's in the Middle East or South America. The United States always supports these military regimes, these corrupt establishments, that never willing to look at who they really are. And then when the dictator becomes, or the chieftain, or whatever you want to call him, becomes controversial or begins to lose power, we dump him, and then we go around and try to reestablish the same forces that we were supporting before we, in this case, helped dump Mubarak.
I think there is a certain temptation for people in power, people in the U.S. foreign policy establishment they inherit, when they come into office, they inherit a set of relationships, in some cases going back decades. And although they kind of know that this won't work forever, the most fervent wish is for it to fall apart on their successor's watch and not on their own. So in a sense, there's a built-in conservatism, built-in refusal to sort of see where we're headed and try and head things off in advance. Instead, we tend to kick the can down the road, and then when it does finally explode, it's much harder for us to manage.
Stephen Walt, professor of at Harvard, we want to you're a guy that reads the Declaration of Independence every 4th of July, you put in your writings. So I wanted to ask you, so you have some knowledge, and certainly a lot of knowledge about revolutions and democratic pursuits. I want to kind of broaden the conversation a little bit to the Arab Spring, of which, everything in Egypt is a part of, and Syria for that matter. So what do you see in all the old arcane language of Thomas Jefferson in America's 237-year-old Declaration of Independence, and in what's going on in Arab, we're going to call Arab Spring. We got right now it's Egypt and Syria, and it seems extremely painful. Is there any correlation we can draw here? Have you seen anything connected?
Well, I think one of the things, I mean, there's several things you could pull from. One is that the aspiration for lives of some freedom, some liberty, to be insulated from excessive government intrusion is a very powerful sense. And that was clearly evident in the Arab Spring, particularly early on. In the Egyptian case, and also I think in Syria, one of the motivations that many of the demonstrators were expressing was a desire for dignity, that they felt that this is what they didn't have. And by dignity, they meant in part to be treated as individual human beings by government institutions, not be victims of corruption or repression or torture or things like that. So that aspiration is definitely there. What I think we have seen, and we've seen it now in Iraq and Afghanistan and a number of other places, is that creating effective democratic institutions turns out to be very, very difficult. Many people may want to live in a democracy or want to not be under the thumb of some tyrant, but then being actually able to construct a set of institutions and a set of attitudes that really work effectively and enjoy a considerable amount of popular support is actually quite hard. We should remind ourselves that the development of democracy in Western Europe and in the United States did not happen overnight.
There you go.
The American government went through multiple iterations and fought a civil war, you know, 80 years after the country's founding, over the basic nature of what our governing institutions and values were going to be. So when we look over at Egypt and say, gee, we were so optimistic about the Arab Spring, and when Mubarak fell, and we thought they would, you know, just create a nice workable democracy now, that's not the way it's worked in France, in Germany, in England, in the United States, in Japan, in lots of places that now have reasonably well-functioning democracies. And that means this calls for a certain amount of patience on our part, but also recognizing that there are going to be many ups and downs and bumps along the road here.
What about, I guess, the complexities of entering these situations? In Syria, we have the Assad government, a rotten government. I don't think there's hardly anyone in the world who thinks it's any good. But many of the minorities in Syria, Christian, Shiite, Alawite, Druze, support the Assad government in the sense that they feel there's more danger in the insurgents than there is from the Assad government. And that creates complexity. How does the United States react to this kind of situation where they're Al-Qaeda influenced and actually publicly Al-Qaeda people on the insurrectionist side, and then we've got a violent dictator on the other side?
Well, first of all, I think Syria, from many different dimensions, is one of the most vexing sorts of challenges we face, because it is impossible to look at the situation there without being horrified by what is happening. But it is also hard to see steps that the United States could take that would reliably yield a better outcome and wouldn't run the risk of dragging us into yet another Middle Eastern quagmire. What Syria tells you, of course, is that the only thing worse than a really bad regime, and the Assad family operation is a really bad regime, but the only thing worse than that is sort of no regime at all, particularly in situations where there's lots of internal divisions along religious and other lines, and where there's at least some presence of violent extremists who are willing to use all sorts of all forms of violence against their particular targets. And that's precisely what's generated the thing you mentioned, the loyalty that a number of groups feel towards a regime that they know is rotten, that they know is not particularly efficient, that didn't run the place particularly well, but did manage to keep social peace among all of these various groups. groups. Yeah, I think the most likely outcome in Syria now is that Assad will remain in power, but not over the entire country, that he'll have a core of the country that he controls, and these other groups will be fighting him and, to some degree, fighting amongst themselves, and this could last for a number of years.
And Syria will be in close to ruins, their economy destroyed in both segments, both the segments and controlled by insurgents and in segments controlled by the Assad family. It's hard to see that how they'll reach the kind of prosperity or any kind of, I don't know, sort of idealistic, as you were talking about the Constitution.
That's many years down the road at this point, and it's not just the economic damage, but it's that civil wars have deeply corrosive and lasting effects on a society. Again, our own civil war is testimony to that. This was a source of great resentment and cultural difference for decades after the end of the Civil War.
Still is.
Some would argue, you know, well into the 1960s, right, there was still this sense in the South of having been ill-treated. And if it took 100 years for the United States to get over the Civil War, you could imagine that what's happening in Syria is not going to be something that everyone just forgets about overnight.
There still is a resentment from Southerners, many of whom immigrated to Arizona.
I was going to say, there's more than a few stars and bars.
My father's side of the family is from the Deep South, and you know the I have heard references to the Great War of Northern Aggression.
So, we still hear it occasionally out here.
You know, we only have a few minutes left, and we do have an announcement or two. But and one thing I criticize my students for is changing topics close to the end of an essay. But one of the big fears we have, and you're going to have to give a short answer to this. One of the biggest fears is the nuclear threat. Keeping nuclear weapons out of the hands of terrorists, and you've written on this. In a minute, tell us why that's not going to happen. Put the whole country at ease there, Professor Walden. Tell us why the terrorists will not get nuclear weapons.
Well, I can't say terrorists will never get nuclear weapons if they steal them from somewhere, which is why we need better security on nuclear material worldwide. But what terrorists are not going to do is they're not going to get it given to them by some government that has them, whether it's Pakistan, or if someday Iran does build a nuclear weapon, they are not going to give it to terrorists. And they're not going to give it because, first of all, there's a very good chance that we would be able to trace that handoff back to them. And if you've gone to enormous lengths to develop one of these weapons, the last thing you're going to do is give it to someone who might use it in a way you didn't approve of, and who might result in you getting punished once we figured out that that's where the bomb came from. So any sort of even minimally rational government would never give something so dangerous off to some independent actor, because they would be putting their own survival at risk.
That's an excellent example of the realist school of foreign policy.
And we've been talking to Stephen Walt, who is a distinguished professor and an innovative thinker, I think, in foreign affairs. A lot of it is technical among the profession.
Well, clear thinking is innovative in foreign policy.
But certainly you should check out his blog, and it's clear, straightforward stuff. Things like suggesting that we give half the money to the Egyptian civilians instead of the military, just plain good common sense.
We are going to, I want to make an announcement here real quickly to ask everybody's indulgence here. We do have a Founders Day brunch coming up to honor the founders of DOR, Democrats of the Red Rocks, a local political organization that supports this show, on August 25th of this year at 11 to 1 p.m. at the Heartline Cafe. Great food, great entertainment. Special speaker Felicia Rodolini will be there, who is a current candidate for state attorney general, and a good candidate, I may add.
It's a great story about how 12 women get together and form an organization that develops into an organization now that has hundreds of members and one of the largest political clubs in northern Arizona. It's a really interesting story. How did they get going? What did they do?
DOR is cool. But also Democrats of the Verde Valley, from the other side of the valley, give support to the show, and we want to recognize them also.
They do indeed. And you have a speaker. You have Felice coming up soon.
Yes, the fourth Thursday in August. If you don't want to drive over to the Founders Day thing, but of course, we will have her in Cottonwood.
And I would recommend looking at Stephen Walt's books, of course, but I would particularly recommend you go on the internet and check out his blog, Straightforward Thinking. You can agree or disagree, but it's certainly clear, don't you think, Mike? And
clear as a bell.
Clear as a bell.
Thanks very much.
And listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.